Mike.
Mike, Bobby Braddock, how are you?
Hey, great. Thank you so much for calling me.
Are you about ready to go?
I'm ready.
I am too.
Okay.
I'm going to have to pretty much stop around four, maybe a couple minutes after. That gives us a half hour if that's okay with you.
That sounds good. Well, as a result of your career as a writer and also as a person who has recorded and played, you had a unique, opportunity to witness a number of different producers. I had a producer once tell me, I don't know how hardly anybody else does it. Producers don't get to watch other producers.
That's true.
And I wondered if you could contrast for me some of the different styles you saw.
Okay, there's the, especially, I mean, my perch is Nashville, of course, and I would say there's the hands-on production style of, which was pretty much how I did it, but Billy Sherrill did that, and so did Owen Bradley,
mm-hmm.
and both of them were musicians. Billy Sherrill was a musician. He was also an engineer, and he was also a songwriter. Billy Sherrill has written more. Billboard has a way of scoring writers' number of points and everything. He's right up there at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, practically all the songs are songs that he produced himself, but I mean, they wouldn't have been hits if they weren't hits. And so he came at it pretty well armed, you know, from all the different origins of producers, which is often from writers or musicians or engineers. He was all those things.
Yeah.
Owen Bradley was pretty much, but both of those men, I think they, from their era, I would be reluctant to say much about those from this era because still being a songwriter whore, I don't want to offend present-day producers. I'm at their mercy.
Yeah.
But from that era, I think Billy Sherrill and Owen Bradley towered way over everybody else. They were the kings.
Yeah.
And there's some, like, I mean, it was said that Chet Atkins had a tendency to sort of let the musicians kind of work it out themselves, even though he was a great musician himself. And you know what? That works too.
Yeah.
And there have been some producers that don't know jack shit, and somehow that seems to work for some of them.
Well, that analogy is often made between producers and film directors, and I think you have that kind of variety in cinema as well.
I always thought that. I tell people, they want to know what is a record producer or music producer's job. I said, think of a director as to film as a producer is to recording.
Yeah. Now tell me a story, and the story would be this, that since people don't know what a producer is, tell me the story of how you learned what a producer was.
In my tenure as a producer was just a few years, and was basically with one artist. It was pretty successful, but it was just that one artist. I mean, he had the biggest debut single in 10 years. So there's not a lot of quantity there, and I swore I would never do it again, even though, I mean, it's equal aspects of love and hate for me.
Yeah.
Like working with Blake Shelton, he was a delight to work with, and going in the studio and recording, I absolutely love that, the creative process and coming up with arrangements. But a lot of the bullshit that goes with the political trappings, you know, I didn't like that.
Yeah.
Didn't like that at all. And, of course, the having to listen to a lot of songs can be pretty grueling. The really great songs are a pleasure. The really bad ones are fun.
Yeah.
The in-between ones are just so boring. It's just, and comping vocals and having, I mean, I know this is a circuitous route for your question, but I'm just stream of consciousness stuff here that you might be able to use to meet and the comping, which of course you know what that involves.
Yeah.
And to me that was just it was awful.
Yeah.
I hated that. The engineer Ed C and I used to we'd have to do things to try to create ways to make it fun. And Blake was a part of the comping too until he got so hot that he was out on the road all the time. Then he, you know,
yeah.
He left that to us. And your question was?
Well, I tell you, let me go with what you were talking about, and that is that you ended up producing Blake Shelton. Was it because you knew him already or because Warner Brothers approached you?
No, they wouldn't have approached me because I was an old songwriter.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't even have thought about me.
Yeah.
I have a friend, Michael Kosser, who was running a small mom and pop type publishing company called Gosnell Music. Well, won't expand on that too much because that's not germane to what we're talking about. Anyway, he was a good friend of mine, and he told me about this kid. He said that, you know, you ought to be producing because, I mean, I had a lot of people tell me, well, you should be producing because your demos sound like records. And I knew they did, and I knew I would love to produce. But I just never did successfully. You know, I never really had that avenue to go down, really. And so he called me up one time. He said, I want you to hear this song. And I didn't pay that much attention to the song. I said, who is that singing? He said, that's the kid I was telling you about, Blake Shelton. That's guy I was telling you I think you should be producing. And I said, well, I want to meet him. And so we met, and I liked him, and he really liked my demos, and he wanted me to produce them. So I went in, I cut a few sides on him, and I peddled him up and down Music Row. I went to the first choice label all the way down to the last choice.
Yeah.
And the last one I went to was Giant Records. Not that it wasn't a good label, but I had heard that they were about to fold. And I went there last, and that's where he landed.
Yeah.
And he, they did indeed fold. They folded a week or two after his record came out. And his record came out only because there was a guy named, his name was Fritz Schulman. He was a promotion man who committed mutiny. He knew the label was going to fold. He sent Blake's record out to radio, and this thing was racing up the charts as they folded.
How about that?
He had a hit record and no label.
Wow.
And Warner, the short version of it is Warner Brothers picked it up.
Yeah.
That was the last place it went to, and that's where he landed. And everybody else passed on him.
Yeah.
And so he got the deal, to answer your question, he got the deal because I believed in him, and I took it around. And then Doug Johnson at Giant Records was just a man of few words, and he said, I like it. And I said, well, I've got him mixed up. I got him up in the mix more than most artists are. He's kind of in your face, but that's kind of, he said, I like it. And so that was it.
Yeah. Now, is it true that you wrote I Want to Talk About Me for Blake Shelton?
I did indeed. I wrote it about a female friend of mine, and I wrote the song in that style because I wanted to write a rap song for Blake because he was going around doing this little rap thing that he had made up that was just very funny. I mean, hearing him, this Oklahoma white boy, doing this rap thing, and he did it really good. It was like a really dirty, very dirty, very funny little rap thing he did.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, he would be a good rapper. I'm going to write this thing for him. And we recorded it. And Giant liked it, but they did research on it. This is before they knew they were going to fold, and the research came back bad. He said not only would this not be a good single, this shouldn't even be on his album. Nobody likes it. So I took it to James Stroud for Toby Keith, and he and Toby loved it, and it was a big hit. And Blake never got over that. He still hasn't quit talking about it. Said he's still scratching his head over that research.
Oh, yeah.
He always says research and always says whatever that is.
They do it with a Ouija board.
I think they may do it with a Ouija board. No, I tell you what they do. They play portions of it over the phone for people.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty stupid, I think. It has nothing to do with a song in its entirety and with the intro and all that.
Yeah. I talked to James Stroud years ago, so it's not that surprising to me that he would be interested. He was a drummer, right?
Yes, a good drummer.
Right, played on a lot of R&B stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to... It's funny, the head of A&R for his label, my publisher pitched it to her, and she said, not only am I passing on this song, I hate this song. And James Stroud, James did not listen to songs. He produced so many people he didn't have time, so I cornered him in a market and said, give me about 3 or 4 minutes. So I had him in the corner, so he called his assistant and said, well, give me 5 minutes for Bobby Braddock. He loved the song, and his head of A&R at the number one party sided up next to the song plugger, and she said, I still hate it. But that's okay.
Yeah. Well, that was that politics just rearing its head immediately when they're doing that research, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was. And the production is, I think there was a lot of that worked out good because I would come up with arrangements and Blake would come over to my house. We'd do like a pre-session rehearsal with the musicians, and he would come over to my house the night before, and I'd run everything by him, make sure he was on board with my arrangements, because I felt the time for he and I to disagree was, you know, in private, not in front of the musicians.
Yeah.
And being a musician myself, I always had a lot of respect with musicians and tried to, I mean, I never... used the Nashville cute term pickers. I always called them players or musicians. In fact, I went to battle with Warner Brothers when they wanted to pay them single instead of double scale, and won. They knew I stood up for them. So I had a good rapport with musicians. And Blake being so funny, they got a kick out of working with him. They love working with him. So,
yeah.
So we had a good thing going with the musicians. I think that had... And a great engineer, Ed C.
Mm-hmm.
And I think without any of those, one of those elements missing, I think the one you could do without the most would be the producer. Because if you have, no matter how good it is, if you got a bad engineer, it's going to sound terrible.
Yeah.
And we had a great engineer.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about, you were talking about doing demos that sounded like recordings and then the reverse. Was that the case with We're Not the Jet Set? I was listening to it the other day, and the Irockin' Tchaikovsky is
Haggard and Husky.
Yeah, and so then you get that little faux classical motif that comes in there in that Billy Sherrill production.
Well, I have to tell you that the demo on We're Not the Jet Set, This was back at a time where I had sort of gone on strike against my publisher, who wanted to have got it in his head that there should be somebody on staff with the writers when they did a demo session. And I refused to do that. And I said, "Well, screw it. I'll do my demos with just a piano." And then I got a Moog synthesizer, bass, and added that. And an engineer was a drummer, so I started doing my own little demos. And they sounded pretty crappy at first, and they got better and better. Then I started adding musicians, and then I'd had a good string of success, and by the time I'd had full musicians, I'd I was getting what I wanted to do anyway, just kind of had to take a long time to go through the back door. So at that time, the demo on We're Not the Jet Set was not very sophisticated, and I don't think it was really all that very good. It was basically me and the Warlocks with electric pen and not much more. He Stopped Loving Her Today wasn't a great demo either. And the original was not even the final song. And Billy Sherrill, I have to credit him with that. He took liberties as a producer. If he didn't like a line in the song, he would change it without even asking the writer, which in most cases that would be a terrible thing to do. In Billy's case, We're Not the Jet Set, there's a line there that Billy threw in there. I had nothing to do with it. At the end of the record, it says, "The Jones and Wynette set ain't the Flaming Suzette set." That was Billy Sherrill.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that, because that made it sound like it was written to order.
Made it sound like it was written...
kind of written to order, right? But I didn't know Billy Sherrill had added it, because I thought, well, Wynette, Jet Set, you got that that rhyme there.
Yeah. No,
but he added that.
He added that, and in most cases, there's one case in Golden Ring that he changed the line. I hated it and still do, but in most cases, Billy Sherrill, when he changed the song, he did it to the better. He was an anomaly, though.
You know? Yeah. Well, what happened? Well, tell me that story on that change in He Stopped Loving Her Today.
Well, when we originally wrote it, we didn't have the recitation in there. And we had verse, and then the chorus came, and the verse and the chorus came. And Billy wanted the chorus to wait, which sort of breaks the cardinal rule in songwriting, because if you go pitch somebody a song and it takes a long time to get to the meat of the song, sometimes they'll turn the player off and won't listen any further. But he wanted that chorus to come later, so that was his idea to do that. And then we had a recitation verse that we wrote. Billy holds to this day, he believes they started recording that song a year and a half before it got finished, and it took George that long, which is, I keep journals, it's absolutely wrong. I tried to tell Billy that, and he will not listen to it.
Yeah. He's
got it in his mind, he believes that. But why would he have gone into, we wrote the recitation verse 2 or 3 days before they recorded in 1980.
Uh-huh.
And I remember Curly Putman and I going back and forth in the snow to Billy's office, taking him the different recitation verses, and it took 4 or 5 till we got one that he really liked. So why would he, a year and a half before, say, well, let's add an extra verse here just in case Bobby Braddock and Curly Putman happen to write a recitation a year and a half from now, which I haven't asked him to do.
You know,
there's no way. So,
yeah.
So that's what happened with that. But I think the production, to me here, here's how the production can make all, I think He Stopped Loving Her Today was, I think it was a good song. I don't think it was the best country song ever written. I think maybe it's the best country record ever made. I think Billy's production, George's singing, elevated it. And what happened is Billy had a reputation back then with the critics for what they felt were his schlocky arrangements. You know, they thought it was too embellished, too much instrumentation, too slick. And in truth, looking back on it, he's now thought of as the producer of some of the greatest traditional country music of our time. It's just traditional country music that was a little more sophisticated, a little more polished.
Yeah.
And I tell people the best part of that record to me is the string section. I mean, it sounds, they have this room full of cellos and violas and violins doing this ascending movement thing. It sounds like the guy's soul is going up to heaven.
Yeah.
And that was Bill McElhiney,
uh-huh,
string arrangement. But Billy told me that he just thought it just kind of sounded kind of flat, just kind of laid there without, you know, and he thought this needs strings. And
yeah.
Bill came up with a string arrangement. to me, that's the best part of the record. And the second best part is Millie Kirkham doing the Angel of Death thing. You know, towards the
book. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say I'm not going to rank them, but I'd say one of those best things is the complexity of the narration itself. So you think about all your narrative possibilities, you know, you think of the overall situation, you think, well, who could be the narrator here? And I think you worked out a really interesting possibility here because it adds some mystery to it.
Yeah, and as I say, George just performed it just perfectly, you know. I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't always, he's a great singer, he doesn't always nail a song, though. He nailed it that day.
Yeah. Now, were you invited to those sessions?
No, Billy Sherrill did not issue invitations to his session. He ruled his sessions with an iron fist. The only Billy Sherrill sessions I ever went to was when he asked me to come there for a reason. You know, I mean, like one time there was Kent Lavoie, who was known as Lobo back in the 70s. He and I wrote a song called Our Boy George.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about George Jones, and Billy wanted George to record it, which made no sense to me. And since they didn't put it out, I guess eventually it didn't make any sense to them. But Billy wanted me to come in and sing it in George's key to George to learn it from. And George was there.
Mm-hmm.
I just sang it. And once he did a thing on Tammy when they had a song of mine called They Call It Making Love.
Yep.
And he called me up. He said, I don't know why, but Tammy wants you to come in and sing this part you did on your demo, and call in and do it. So I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then Deborah Allen and I wrote a duet for George and Deborah, and he had me there for that. But unless there was a specific reason, he did not want people coming to his sessions.
I see. Well, help me with this, and that is, if you would be willing to take a song of your choice and say, now here's... We can work it from conception to its birth as a record, or we could just think of it as kind of the alimentary canal or something, you know, where it just, here's where you came up with it, here's how, and from your desk, I'm curious about where it goes, you know, how does it go to the publisher first, when's the demo get made, how's it go then to, you know, the label? I'm not quite sure I'm straight on that protocol.
Okay, tell me this. When will your book be published?
It's going to be, the manuscript is due in late April, and it would then be published. They'll send it out to readers. They'll get word on it in the fall, and it'll probably take about a year in production.
Okay, I got you. Yeah, University Press is, I mean, because...
They're crazy, aren't they?
Was with LSU Press.
I knew that, yeah.
Yeah, I remember you wrote me about that.
Yeah.
And they have their readers, that's right. And
that's right.
So you're talking about a couple of years.
Well, if you can hurry up those academics and get them to weigh in on it a little faster, you can shave a little bit of time. But, yeah, it's about a year in production.
Well, the reason I ask is my inclination is between you and me, instead of to LSU Press, which I'm sort of obligated to, but we both have right of first refusal. I think I want this to go with the Vanderbilt Hall of Fame Press.
Yeah.
And you familiar with that little they have sort of a co-venture thing?
I am familiar with that.
Yeah.
They've done nice stuff.
Okay, so you've had a book with them?
No, I have not had a book with them. I have a book with SUNY Press, and I have a book with Temple University Press, and this one's going to be with Wesleyan. And the Wesleyan one was because there was a call for oral histories, and I had thought about the Vanderbilt Press myself, but that oral history one was so seductive because I had talked to a lot of producers already, and I thought, well, I'm going to call some people that I haven't talked to.
Well, your oral history, then, is going to be pretty much the manuscript will be in the exact words of the interview, then, right?
That's exactly right. Other people's voices put in order. I'm comping vocals.
Okay. All right. So this changed the complexity of what I was going to throw at you then. I was just going to say, just out of instinctively trusting you, I was going to say, my book, another reason I wanted to go there, I think I can maybe have it out in this coming fall. It could very well be spring of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
But I go through, I sort of deconstruct and do the anatomy of a song from conception to the end. It's a thing called Mark Chestnut called Old Flames Have New Names.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why I picked that song, but I just did. It's not certainly not one of my biggest things, but it was big. And thought, well, I might just send you a manuscript for that. But this being oral history, I'll just say that well, for instance, with that song, I know that and of course this has nothing to do with production. We're talking about the writing of it.
Well, I think in a large way it has to do with production, right?
Okay.
As the creation of recordings. Yeah.
Well, the swath includes the production.
That's right.
Okay. So I start out, Rafe Van Hoy taught me, I was at their house. He was then married to Deborah Allen, and we were all very, very close, and I said, I'd like to write a song sometime like All My Exes Live in Texas. And Rafe said something about, how about this guy who had all these women and went away and came back, and they all had new names. I said, like, all my old flames have new names? He said, yeah, that's it. So I went home and started it and then called him up, and we wrote it. We finished writing it on the phone. And so a publisher wasn't wild about it, but said, yeah, well, if you feel strongly about it, go ahead and demo it. So I did, and two of the song pluggers had a meeting with Mark Wright, who was producing Mark Chestnut. And one of the song pluggers, named Walter Campbell, liked that song, took it along. Mark liked it, put it on hold. That hole being a producer's hole, which meant it was on hold until the artist heard it. Mark Chestnut liked it, then it was an artist hole, and so that was a good solid hole. Nobody else was going to get to hear it. And I know they went through a process of saying that they really liked it, it was going to be the first single. Then they were saying it wouldn't be the first single. I was upset about that, and then they went in and cut it. I remember going by the session, and I remember fiddle player Rob Hajek is telling me, whoa, I'm wrong. I'm on another song. I'm on Time Marches On. Sometimes songs come together.
Yeah.
So, but we did go by the session right after it was cut, and he played it for me, and I really liked it a lot. And we called it Old Flames with New Name. That's what Rafe and I called it.
Mm-hmm.
And my publisher, Donna Hilly, told us later. Well, I remember Rafe and I went out and had drinks with Mark Wright and Mark Chestnut. Okay, so they recorded it. So then that means that the publisher is going to issue them a license. Can't put something out until the publisher gives you a license.
Uh-huh.
Publisher has total control over the first person to put a song out. After that, anybody in the world can do it.
Okay.
And so then my publisher told me, he said, Mark Wright called me up and said, they want to change the title from Old Flames with New Names to Old Flames Have New Names. And I said, I don't like it as well. Let me ask Rafe about it. And she said, well, I already told him he could do it, which I really did not like at all.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was coming out of, I mean, my whole career has been feast and famine, you know.
Yeah.
One right after the other. And I was coming out of a famine wanting a feast, so I didn't say anything about it. And liked the record. And so then they changed their mind from it not being the first single to it being the first single again. And it came out, and there you have it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I had to say my favorite, best produced country record it would be a contest between he stopped loving her today and Vince Gill's Go Rest High on That Mountain.
Uh-huh.
I think that is just an absolutely great record. That was Tony Brown. I'm sure Vince had input to it. Tony is a great producer.
He is a great producer.
And Vince has such great musical skills. I'm sure he had some. And I tell you what's so great about that. It breaks all the rules. It's too long to be a single to start with. And I don't know. I think if I were producing, I probably would have said, no, we certainly can't have an instrumental turnaround here. That would make it way too long, you know. They had the good sense to go ahead, even though it was that long, to put a fiddle solo in it. And then after that, here comes Vince playing a guitar solo.
Yeah.
It's almost like thumbing their nose at it, saying, well, we'll see how long we can make this, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an eternity. And it didn't get to number one. It was, I don't know, maybe number 9 or 10 on the charts, I think.
Yeah.
But it was an eternal song. I mean, it's the song that keeps on giving. And He Stopped Loving Today has been, too. And I know when I had, I was nominated for Time Marches On as Song of the Year, and Vince told me, he said, well, if my song doesn't get it, I hope yours does.
Uh-huh.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
So when he won, I didn't mind because of that, and I also knew that his song, which he wrote about Keith Whitley and about his brother, meant more to him, I think, than mine did to me. But anyway, the production on that, I thought was just stellar. I think
yeah.
It doesn't get any better. They had Ricky Skaggs and Patti Loveless singing harmony. It's just a wonderful, wonderful. Tony is a very emotional guy. He's been known to cry after hearing playback.
Yeah.
And I think that, the fact that he is an emotional man came through in such an emotional record. And of course, like I say, I think Vince Gill is sort of a genius himself, you know.
Yeah. I know it was years ago that I talked, years ago I started this project, but I talked to Tony Brown right after he had produced the Key with Vince Gill.
Produced which?
That album, The Key, I think it's called.
Oh, okay.
The one that's it's kind of retro. It almost sounds like a Owen Bradley kind of production.
Huh.
And he told me, you know, one of the tunes he said, I said to Pig, you know, play me one of those famous introductions. And he said, and he got all excited about it talking to me. I hear exactly what you're saying. He said I was just jumping up and down in the control room. So yeah.
Well, I read that Tony cried when he heard the playback to Wynonna's She Is His Only Need.
Yeah.
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 And I like that. I think that's a good thing. I could see more passion in producing. I wasn't going to say anything about contemporary producers. It's funny. I told Frank Liddell how much I liked his production. He said, I don't do much. I just kind of sit there and let the musicians play. And I noticed his records really do stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to my publisher, song plugging end of the publisher, Terry Wakefield. I told him what Frank had said, and he said, oh, he said, that's just, I mean, he's just trying to be modest guy. He said, it's not true at all. He said, he puts his stamp on those records. I said, I think so, too.
Yeah. Well, give me one example, then, about you being a real hands-on guy with Blake Shelton and those, especially those three recordings you did with him, where you were the primary.
I generally have parts that I want to hear the different instruments playing, groove that I want it to be in. The one exception to that is Brent Rowan, who I've been working with since he was in his early 20s. And in spite of all I'm saying, there is a duo I'm working with now. It just kind of fell in my lap, and I'm sort of getting excited about it. And I wouldn't be surprised to get them a deal. And it's very unusual. It's a mother-son duo.
Wow.
And they sound great.
Yep.
And the reaction so far has been super. All right, what was the question? Sorry.
Giving me an example of you working as a hands-on kind
okay,
of guy.
Yeah, right. Okay, so My one exception to that, I was saying, was Brent Rowan, who I've been working with since he was very, very young. And we know each other so well, it's almost like we can read each other's minds. And with all the things I want the instruments to play, I got to the point where I would leave sort of a blank spot for Brent, knowing that he'd come up with something great, like the intro to Time Marches On. Even though he didn't play on the record, the other Brent, Brent Mason, did. What Brent did was so, it was such an important part of that song that, you know, they had to play it. See, here you have Brent Mason playing Brent Rowan's licks. And he probably didn't like doing that,
yeah.
But he executed it beautifully. And I want to talk about me, the intro, guitar intro on that. That is pure Brent.
Uh-huh.
All the other stuff is mine. I know when we, for instance, we did a song called Some Beach with Blake.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know the song. It was number one for 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that song?
I know it, but I don't know it well.
Well, we cut it. I mean, the thing is, the point is, the guy gets exasperated and he says, some beach, like he's saying, son of a bitch.
Right.
And it's some beach somewhere, and it shows, you know, and it's kind of this dreamy chorus where he's talking about being on an island on a beach, you know. It's a very clever song. Paul Overstreet and Roy Thicke wrote it. And we cut it, and it had kind of an island sound. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I said, none of these Kenny Chesney things, and then the Jimmy Buffett things out there. And this is going to end up sounding like one of their records. I said, why don't we start over and break this down, and just take what would. Some of what we got and turned this into kind of a garage band thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to Ed C's studio, Cool Tools, and we broke it down, and all we left from the original was the kick drum.
Mm.
And I got Brent to come in there, and he's a great stacker. And that record is, majority of it is Brent Rowan. It's like a one-man band. And I said, let's do it the same tempo, but play something twice as fast as that, almost like you're playing double time to that tempo. And he came with this intro that sounded to me, I said, that sounds kind of like Third Rate Romance. He said, well, I'll do something else. I said, no, let's do that. And he did that, and it was mostly Brent stacking stuff. Ed C. got some drum sounds from the computer, and Paul Franklin came. With Paul Franklin, I said in my book that Paul Franklin is arguably the best steel guitar player in the world, and Dan Dugmore is arguably the best steel guitar player in the world. They're both great.
Mm-hmm.
And on this particular thing, I used Dan a lot, but with Blake, weren't able to get Dan on a session, ended up using Paul Franklin and continued to, because he just seemed to work really well on Blake's stuff. I would sit down with Paul, because I'm sort of a steel guitar aficionado. I love steel guitar. I know steel guitar players. I play pretty decent piano. I wish I played pretty decent steel.
Yeah.
I love the instrument. And so I would sit down with Paul Franklin and tell him exactly the licks I wanted. I'd hum them to him. And he told me, he says, you're the only person that does that. When he said, I look forward to these sessions because he said, I wouldn't want to do this all the time. He said, but it works out so well between us. He said, I love doing that because
wow.
It's so totally different. So Paul came in and played steel on what Brent had stacked. And we had Eric Darthon, you know, some percussion guy came in and put something in. And Tim Lauer, I think maybe overdubbed some organ. But it was like from scratch, hands-on. And we totally tore one down and built another one up, and it was a big hit. And it didn't sound. And I told Paul, I said, let's leave in two island or Mediterranean sounding things on there, but all the rest of them, let's put just standard country steel guitar licks, you know.
Well, that certainly describes why it's such a protracted process compared to, let's say, especially one of those rough demos you once would have done. Yeah.
And the stacking thing is, I don't know how many records have been recorded that way. Not many. It's the only one that, no, we did two, but it's the only single we ever did that was done that way from, you know, the ground up, just stacking it.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you really get hands-on because you're not missing anything because you're there for every element, you know.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one more question, and this is on Golden Ring, and you've raised my curiosity even talking about third-rate romance there. And on Golden Ring, you not only have that this kind of echo of Shall a Circle Be Unbroken, but Long Black Veil. Are those kind of meta comments about other country songs in your mind when you work those, or do they come out in the arrangement? How's that showing up in the progression from composition to production?
Oh, that's very funny because you bring that up because I was on a TV show with Mary John Wilkin and God, what was the guy's name who wrote Long Black Veil with her?
I just remember Lefty Frizzell singing it.
Yeah, was yeah.
But I don't remember who wrote that.
Look in the Whitmer book; it would be in there.
Yeah, I will.
But you probably have one that has the writers in there.
Yeah, I'll plug that in.
Okay, well, Danny Dill.
So okay.
They were. I had told we were on the show together, and we're talking about Golden Ring. And I said, my publisher was talking about suing on Conway Twitty's I'd Love to Lay You Down because it's so much like Golden Ring. And I said, and I told them, and I said this in front of Mary John and Danny on this TV show. I said, I told my publisher, don't do that because then Mary John Wilkin and Danny Dill turn around and sue us on Golden Ring. And Mary John said, we came close. We came close to doing that. But I think if you go back far enough, you'll find some old gospel song that sounds like that, you know, anyway. And with that, I wanted to write a song for George and Tammy that sounded like there was an old gospel group called the Chuck Wagon Gang.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sort of like old-timey Baptist or maybe even Pentecostal-type singing, which is them and a guitar.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write a song for George and Tammy like that. And I got with Rafe Van Hoy, and I started the song, and I was stuck on it. And I called Curly Putman to see if he wanted to come in, and he didn't want to leave his farm. And Rafe walked in the door, and his mother worked at a jewelry store. And I said, well, why don't you write this with me? And I don't think Rafe wrote a lot on it, but he made up for it. But I was going out of town the next day. And I knew George and Tammy were recording soon, and I wanted to get it demoed. And Rafe is a great singer and guitar player. And I said, why don't you just go in there and sing a bunch of parts on it and do it kind of like the Chuck Wagon Gang, kind of hillbilly gospel. And, oh, my God, the little demo he did on that is wonderful.
Hmm.
It sounds kind of like the Chuck Wagon Gang.
Oh, yeah.
And took it over to George and Tammy. My publisher produced Bill Anderson. He tried to find Bill Anderson, couldn't find him, so he went ahead with my instincts and pitched it to Billy Sherrill for George and Tammy. They recorded it within a few days after it was written, and a very few weeks after that, maybe 3-4 weeks, it was playing on the radio.
Yeah.
And Billy cut it in that spirit, but he did his own little things on it. He had the Gatlin brothers singing harmony, doing the answer harmony. Wonderful, wonderful record. Had a great guitar intro, and he did the first part of it without the drums, and then the drums came in later.
Yeah.
Changed the line in it that I did not like, but aside from that.
Right. Well, when you were signed to Tree in '66, is it true that you were, I don't know, it's almost like there was a Roger Miller chair in that, a chair of songwriting that you, but you did fill in a slot that he had vacated, was that correct?
Well, Billy, Buddy Killen seemed to think that. He thought I was going to be the next Roger Miller. Obviously, I wasn't, because I was not a successful artist, even though I was on 5 major labels. I tell people that shows how easy it used to be to get a record deal, that I was on 5 major labels. And I'm just not nearly as good an artist as Roger was. But it was kind of I think Buddy thought of it as being that Roger Miller chair. And
yeah,
that's one of the reasons, I think, that led me there. They had just become the number one company in town, but they didn't tower over the other companies, Cedarwood and Aco Rose. And Roger had moved to the West Coast.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would be an ideal. And to be honest with you, a Ouija board told me to go there.
Yeah.
you mentioned Ouija board earlier.
Really? A real Ouija board?
A real Ouija board.
No shit. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, on this thing on producing country music, I'm trying to just be ridiculously open-minded about what counts as country, and I'm definitely using those Joe Tex things that Buddy Killen did, because I think Joe Tex was just the most countrified of all great soul singers. So,
you know, that's very interesting. I get what you're saying there. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And Buddy Killen did. I was on one of his records. A bunch of us were. It's Skinny Legs and All.
Yeah.
The audience reaction thing.
Yeah. My wife despises that song because she had skinny legs. But, you know, that's a downside when you're 17. But when you get to be in your late 50s, it's a plus.
And don't forget, Joe Tex also did the very politically incorrect now thing, going to bump an old big fat woman.
I know it.
That was. I think the most countrified black singer was Chuck Berry.
Oh yeah, he was. He loved country music. That's true.
I think
true.
He was hillbilly R&B, and he's. I think he, other than Lieber and Stoller, I think he was the first great rock and roll lyricist.
Yeah, he was great. Well, I think Otis Redding was pretty countrified. Yeah. So.
And Ray Charles could be when he wanted to be.
That's right. Yeah. Well, on this project, one of the people I talked to as well was Sid Feller, who produced that record with Ray Charles.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Whew.
Oh my God! What a record!
Beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, it's timeless. It's just, it's just perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
If I had to name the 10 best records of all time, that would definitely fall in there.
Boy, it would be in there for me too.
And What I Say would be in there too. I have to say, yes.
Yeah.
It had a big influence on my life.
Yeah. Well, while we're picking those, I'd pick another one that's a little bit outside of mainstream country is Dusty in Memphis. Dusty Springfield's record does it for me a lot of times. So I love that one.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that what they did there was, Chips Moman wasn't the producer, but Wexler and Dowd coming in and doing that with those guys in Memphis. I love that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I do, too. That's a great one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm not going to keep you anymore. It's so much fun to talk to you, though.
Well, I'm going
to
be late for what I was doing, but I don't care. This is better than what I was going to be doing. meet up with some relatives passing through town.
Well, you can make me the bad cop, then.
Well, listen, I tell you that a couple of interesting books, one that has a lot to do with production is Jack Eisenhower's book. Did you read that? Have you seen that?
I don't know that book, no.
Okay. It's called He Stopped Loving Her Today, and the subtitle is, this is the longest subtitle in the world, George Jones, Billy Sherrill, and the pretty much totally true story of the making of the greatest country record of all time.
Oh, yeah, okay. I looked at that on Google Books one night, yeah.
And he got it pretty much right. He could have made a stronger case about, you know, the recitation on He Stopped Loving. He put both sides and said, you know, he was puzzled. And then there's another, a guy named Bob Keeling, written a book about Graham Parsons. I've seen two Graham, because I knew him, he and I were from the same county. We were both from Polk County.
Yeah, I said my mother-in-law was born in Winter. And you know where my father-in-law was born?
Where?
Waycross, Georgia.
Wow, so there's the Graham Parsons connection.
That's right.
There. Well, I had read, because I knew him and was part of that, I mean, he told about something that I had never even considered, and that was what he calls the youth center circuit or teen center circuit of Central Florida. And I thought it was that way everywhere. I didn't know it was just something that was indigenous to that part of the country. And Tom Petty and Dwayne and the Allman Brothers came from that. And he talks about the Auburndale-Winter Haven corridor, which was included me in that, along with Jim Stafford and Graham Parsons and Lobo and was known as the Chambers Boys, who wrote some country hits too. And I've read a couple of books about Graham Parsons that I didn't get into. This one's unputdownable because, I found great writers like Robert Caro and even Peter Guralnick, who is my hero. Who you've read his Elvis books, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah, and very good friend. I found one little tiny thing in his, and it simply had to do with religion and had to do with the Church of Christ. And to me he's a writing god. I mean, but this guy, I don't find anything wrong in there. I mean, and I could find so many errors because I was a part of that. And it's a fascinating book about Graham Parsons. And it's funny, we had a reunion down there, and I nicknamed it Polk Cats. and I told Stafford and Lobo, I said, I'll be honest with you, I never got Graham Parsons. They laughed and they said, we never did either.
Yeah.
But after hearing some of his music, I do hear some really wonderful stuff. I mean, especially some stuff he did with Emmylou. Anyway,
yeah.
It's called Calling Me Home, and it's a very, very good book.
Yeah, I'll look at that. I've always admired in him his willingness to stand straight in front of the Stones or whomever, the Birds, and just more or less testify to his love of country music. He wasn't afraid to do that.
He did that, and his good friend Jim Carlton told him, well, I didn't say anything disparaging about him because I knew they were friends. I said, I never knew Graham very well, and, you know, I love his music, and he seemed a little hurt, and he said, he really admired you. He looked up to you, and I felt kind of bad, you know, when he said that, and because he used me on some demo sessions back
then. Yeah.
He was, like, you know, a few years younger than me. He was a kid.
Yeah.
Rich kid. Listen, I would say this. I do talk about the vernacular. I catch a little Southern in your voice. Now, you lived in Tampa 15 years.
Yeah, that was that. But it's not Tampa, is it? You want to guess?
Were you born in Florida?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't have been surprised because I do hear a touch of Southern in
Well,
your
I'm
voice.
I'm a tough one because I'm a hybrid here. Two Southern cities.
Okay.
Half my life in one and half my life in the other, neither of them in Florida.
Okay, let me guess here. My God, would it be Arkansas?
That's a good guess, but I think that's Texas? More the hybrid. It's the Old South, Atlanta and Chattanooga.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Atlanta's kind of, I don't know how old you are. From what you said about late 50s wife, I figured that maybe you're around 60 or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, yeah, an Atlantan of 60 would talk Southern, and an Atlantan of 30 or 40 would not.
That's right.
And kids of 20, I've noticed this about the way people speak, and nobody's ever written about it, and I touched some of it on my new book, but not a lot because I know that's not what people want to read about if they buy this book. But that's that. It's become a class thing. Like in Britain, the upper classes have the same accent no matter where they're from in the UK.
Yeah.
And it's what they call the Oxford accent, or sometimes the BBC accent. the proletariat, they have their accent varies from Liverpool to London to Manchester to Birmingham.
Yeah.
In the United States, it's becoming that too.
Yeah.
Like I noticed in Nashville, where I spent all my adult years, you go into the upper class part of the town, you hear the grandmother speaking that old South, leaving off the R's, that deep South.
Yeah.
That their daughters have just a touch of Southern, not a lot, and their grandchildren, you know, have the Valley accent.
Yeah.
And I hear the Valley accent getting up towards middle age now, and some, but you go to the working class parts of Nashville, I mean, they still talk like rednecks.
Right.
And so I think the same thing happening here is what happened in the UK, you know, a long time ago.
I think so too. I in my own self, because I hear myself too much when I transcribe, but I hear the proletariat, Atlantan or Chattanoogan. I don't hear that lilt of money. It's not there.
Well, I had a non-Southern speaking girlfriend who told me one time, her name was Tammy, and she would mock me. She'd say, "Come on, Tammy, come on." And I became so aware that I was saying on, and that I started saying not the Northern on, but somewhere, I think I split the difference somewhere. That's because of her. And I heard an old interview of me, that was in my first book, an interview I did with my father, and I was shocked at how Southern I sounded when I was 20 as compared to now, you know. And my father sounded like, you know, he was from the Mississippi Delta.
Oh, yeah. I know it. I think of myself being real Southern, but then I've met some people I went to high school with, and I think, man, you know, what was I, what were, wow.
I know. Or, I go to this high school reunions, and I think, who are all these old people, you know? What am
right.
I doing here? I'm sure they look at me and think the same thing. You know?
Yeah. Well, back to Atlanta, I'm thinking, I lived in Atlanta when our ball team, you were there when it was true, we were the Crackers, and we were proud of it.
Yeah, the Atlanta Crackers, absolutely, yeah.
I'm a Cracker, and I'm proud of it. I'm thinking, that's pretty disparaging nowadays. Who saddled that one on us?
Well, I know. It was, well, Crackers, they were Georgia Crackers and
Florida
Crackers, and I don't think I ever heard that. That as a suffix to any other state.
That's
know?
Right. Yeah, those Florida Crackers, they were cattle drivers.
That's right, yeah. And then they say it went back to the crack of the whip or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So my parents, cracker meant, you know, born in Florida, you know. They didn't look at it, you know, as a pejorative term.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Anyway, I enjoyed this.
I did too.
It's great.
Tremendous pleasure. Thank you so much.
And if there's any follow-up, don't hesitate to get in touch with me about it, you know? And
thank
I'm excited
you.
About what you're doing, and I can't wait to read it, you know?
I can't wait to get it done. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for your time.
If there's a form I can read it in, I mean, before it's on the streets, if it's even, you know, a month early or something, or whenever it's possible to do that, I mean, you don't know me well enough to trust me. I would love to read it. Not the part about me. I mean,
yeah.
Just the whole thing. It's an exciting thing about.
Oh, I'm gonna take you up on that. I'm gonna take you up on that because I need some feedback.
If you want an extra reader, I would love reading because it's. I mean, if I saw it in the bookstore, I'd run across there and grab it up and take it home with me.
Terrific, terrific. I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay, and if I get any other thoughts, not just on my production, but anybody's production, I'll email you.
Okay, thank you, Bobby.
All right,
okay.
Stay in touch if you need to, and I appreciate it so
Will
much.
Will do. All right, thank
take
you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.